Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 7 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 7. On the following Sunday morning, Mr. Mordaunt had a large congregation. Indeed, he could scarcely remember any Sunday on which the church had been so crowded. People appeared upon the scene who seldom did him the honor of coming to hear his sermons. There were even people from Hazleton, which was the next parish. There were hardy, sunburned farmers, stout, comfortable, apple-cheeked wives in their best bonnets and most gorgeous shawls, and half a dozen children or so to each family. The doctor's wife was there with her four daughters. Mrs. Kimsey and Mr. Kimsey, who kept the druggist's shop and made pills and did up powders for everybody within 10 miles, sat in their pew. Mrs. Dibble in hers. Miss Smith, the village dressmaker, and her friend Miss Perkins, the milliner, sat in theirs. The doctor's young man was present, and the druggist's apprentice. In fact, almost every family on the countryside was represented, in one way or another. In the course of the preceding week, many wonderful stories had been told of little Lord Fauntleroy. Mrs. Dibble had been kept so busy attending to customers who came in to buy a pennyworth of needles or a ha'porth of tape, and to hear what she had to relate, that the little shop bell over the door had nearly tinkled itself to death over the coming and going. Mrs. Dibble knew exactly how his small lordship's rooms had been furnished for him, what expensive toys had been bought, how there was a beautiful brown pony awaiting him, and a small groom to attend it, and a little dog cart with silver-mounted harness. And she could tell, too, what all the servants had said when they had caught glimpses of the child on the night of his arrival, and how every female below stairs had said it was a shame, so it was, to part the poor pretty dear from his mother, and had all declared their hearts came into their mouths when he went alone into the library to see his grandfather, for there was no knowing how he'd be treated, and his lordship's temper was enough to fluster them with old heads on their shoulders, let alone a child. "But if you'll believe me, Mrs. Jennifer, mum," Mrs. Dibble had said, "fear that child does not know. So Mr. Thomas hisself says, and set and smile he did, and talk to his lordship as if they'd been friends ever since his first hour. And the Earl so took aback, Mr. Thomas says, that he couldn't do nothing but listen and stare from under his eyebrows. And it's Mr. Thomas's opinion, Mrs. Bates, mum, that, bad as he is, he was pleased in his secret soul, and proud, too, for a handsomer little fellow, or with better manners, though so old-fashioned, Mr. Thomas says, he'd never wish to see. And then there had come the story of Higgins. The Reverend Mr. Mordaunt had told it at his own dinner table, and the servants who had heard it had told it in the kitchen, and from there it had spread like wildfire. And on market day, when Higgins had appeared in town, he had been questioned on every side. And Newick had been questioned too, and in response had shown to two or three people the note signed Fauntleroy. And so the farmers' wives had found plenty to talk of over their tea and their shopping, and they had done the subject full justice, and made the most of it. And on Sunday, they had either walked to church or had been driven in their gigs by their husbands, who were perhaps a trifle curious themselves about the new little lord who was to be in time the owner of the soil. It was by no means the Earl's habit to attend church, but he chose to appear on this first Sunday. It was his whim to present himself in the huge family pew with Fauntleroy at his side. There were many loiterers in the churchyard and many lingerers in the lane that morning. There were groups at the gates and in the porch, and there had been much discussion as to whether my lord would really appear or not. When this discussion was at its height, one good woman suddenly uttered an exclamation. "Eh," she said, "that must be the mother, pretty young thing." All who heard turned and looked at the slender figure in black coming up the path. The veil was thrown back from her face, and they could see how fair and sweet it was, and how the bright hair curled as softly as a child's under the little widow's cap. She was not thinking of the people about. She was thinking of Cedric and of his visits to her and his joy over his new pony, on which he had actually ridden to her door the day before, sitting very straight and looking very proud and happy. But soon she could not help being attracted by the fact that she was being looked at and that her arrival had created some sort of sensation. She first noticed it because an old woman in a red cloak made a bobbing courtesy to her, and then another did the same thing and said, "God bless you, my lady." And one man after another took off his hat as she passed. For a moment she did not understand, and then she realized that it was because she was little Lord Fauntleroy's mother that they did so, and she flushed rather shyly and smiled and bowed too and said, "Thank you," in a gentle voice to the old woman who had blessed her. To a person who had always lived in a bustling, crowded American city, this simple deference was very novel, and at first just a little embarrassing. But, after all, she could not help liking and being touched by the friendly warm-heartedness of which it seemed to speak. She had scarcely passed through the stone porch into the church before the great event of the day happened. The carriage from the castle, with its handsome horses and tall liveried servants, bowled around the corner and down the green lane. "Here they come," went from one looker-on to another. And then the carriage drew up, and Thomas stepped down and opened the door, and a little boy dressed in black velvet and with a splendid mop of bright waving hair jumped out. Every man, woman, and child looked curiously upon him. "He's the captain over again," said those of the onlookers who remembered his father. "He's the captain's self to the life." He stood there in the sunlight looking up at the Earl, as Thomas helped that nobleman out, with the most affectionate interest that could be imagined. The instant he could help, he put out his hand and offered his shoulder as if he had been 7 feet high. It was plain enough to everyone that, however it might be with other people, the Earl of Dorincourt struck no terror into the breast of his grandson. "Just lean on me," they heard him say. "How glad the people are to see you, and how well they all seem to know you." "Take off your cap, Fauntleroy," said the Earl. "They are bowing to you." "To me?" cried Fauntleroy, whipping off his cap in a moment, burying his bright head to the crowd, and turning shining, puzzled eyes on them as he tried to bow to everyone at once. "God bless your lordship," said the curtsying, red-cloaked old woman who had spoken to his mother. "Long life to you." "Thank you, ma'am," said Fauntleroy. And then they went into the church and were looked at there, on their way up the aisle to the square, red-cushioned and curtained pew. When Fauntleroy was fairly seated, he made two discoveries which pleased him. The first that, across the church where he could look at her, his mother sat and smiled at him. The second that at one end of the pew, against the wall, knelt two quaint figures carven in stone, facing each other as they kneeled on either side of a pillar supporting two stone missals, their pointed hands folded as if in prayer, their dress very antique and strange. On the tablet by them was written something, of which he could only read the curious words, "Here lieth ye body of Gregory Arthur, first Earl of Dorincourt, also of Alison Hildegard, his wife." "May I whisper?" inquired his lordship, devoured by curiosity.
"What is it?" said his grandfather.
"Who are they?"
"Some of your ancestors," answered the Earl, "who lived a few hundred years ago."
"Perhaps," said Lord Fauntleroy, regarding them with respect, "perhaps I got my spelling from them."
And then he proceeded to find his place in the church service. When the music began, he stood up and looked across at his mother, smiling. He was very fond of music, and his mother and he often sang together. So he joined in with the rest, his pure, sweet, high voice rising as clear as the song of a bird. He quite forgot himself in his pleasure in it. The Earl forgot himself a little, too, as he sat in his curtain-shielded corner of the pew and watched the boy. Cedric stood with the big psalter open in his hands, singing with all his childish might, his face a little uplifted happily. And as he sang, a long ray of sunshine crept in and, slanting through a golden pane of a stained-glass window, brightened the falling hair about his young head. His mother, as she looked at him across the church, felt a thrill pass through her heart, and a prayer rose in it too, a prayer that the pure, simple happiness of his childish soul might last, and that the strange, great fortune which had fallen to him might bring no wrong or evil with it. There were many soft, anxious thoughts in her tender heart in those new days. "Oh, Ceddie," she had said to him the evening before, as she hung over him and sang good night before he went away. "Oh, Ceddie, dear, I wish for your sake I was very clever and could say a great many wise things. But only be good, dear. Only be brave. Only be kind and true always. And then you will never hurt anyone so long as you live. And you may help many, and the big world may be better because my little child was born. And that is best of all, Ceddie. It is better than everything else that the world should be a little better because a man has lived. Even ever so little better, dearest." And on his return to the castle, Fauntleroy had repeated her words to his grandfather. "And I thought about you when she said that," he ended. "And I told her that was the way the world was because you had lived. And I was going to try if I could be like you."
"And what did she say to that?" asked his lordship a trifle uneasily.
"She said that was right, and we must always look for good in people and try to be like it."
Perhaps it was this the old man remembered as he glanced through the divided folds of the red curtain of his pew. Many times he looked over the people's heads to where his son's wife sat alone, and he saw the fair face the unforgiven dead had loved, and the eyes which were so like those of the child at his side. But what his thoughts were, and whether they were hard and bitter or softened a little, it would have been hard to discover. As they came out of church, many of those who had attended the service stood waiting to see them pass. As they neared the gate, a man who stood with his hat in his hand made a step forward and then hesitated. He was a middle-aged farmer with a careworn face.
"Well, Higgins," said the Earl.
Fauntleroy turned quickly to look at him.
"Oh," he exclaimed, "is it Mr. Higgins?"
"Yes," answered the Earl dryly. "And I suppose he came to take a look at his new landlord."
"Yes, my lord," said the man, his sunburned face reddening. "Mr. Newick told me his young lordship was kind enough to speak for me, and I thought I'd like to say a word of thanks, if I might be allowed."
Perhaps he felt some wonder when he saw what a little fellow it was who had innocently done so much for him, and who stood there looking up just as one of his own less fortunate children might have done, apparently not realizing his own importance in the least.
"I've a great deal to thank your lordship for," he said. "A great deal.
"Oh," said Fauntleroy, "I only wrote the letter. It was my grandfather who did it, but you know how he is about always being good to everybody. Is Mrs. Higgins well now?"
Higgins looked a trifle taken aback. He also was somewhat startled at hearing his noble landlord presented in the character of a benevolent being, full of engaging qualities.
"Well, yes, your lordship," he stammered. "The missus is better since the trouble was took off her mind. It was worrying broke her down."
"I'm glad of that," said Fauntleroy.
"My grandfather was very sorry about your children having the scarlet fever, and so was I. He has had children himself. I'm his son's little boy, you know."
Higgins was on the verge of being panic-stricken. He felt it would be the safer and more discreet plan not to look at the Earl, as it had been well known that his fatherly affection for his sons had been such that he had seen them about twice a year, and that when they had been ill, he had promptly departed for London, because he would not be bored with doctors and nurses. It was a little trying, therefore, to his lordship's nerves to be told, while he looked on, his eyes gleaming from under his shaggy eyebrows, that he felt an interest in scarlet fever.
"You see, Higgins," broke in the Earl with a fine, grim smile, "you people have been mistaken in me. Lord Fauntleroy understands me. When you want reliable information on the subject of my character, apply to him. Get into the carriage, Fauntleroy."
And Fauntleroy jumped in, and the carriage rolled away down the green lane, and even when it turned the corner into the high road, the Earl was still grimly smiling. End of chapter 7. Chapter 8 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 8. Lord Dorincourt had occasion to wear his grim smile many a time as the days passed by. Indeed, as his acquaintance with his grandson progressed, he wore the smile so often that there were moments when it almost lost its grimness. There is no denying that before Lord Fauntleroy had appeared on the scene, the old man had been growing very tired of his loneliness and his gout and his 70 years. After so long a life of excitement and amusement, it was not agreeable to sit alone, even in the most splendid room, with one foot on a gout stool and with no other diversion than flying into a rage and shouting at a frightened footman who hated the sight of him. The old Earl was too clever a man not to know perfectly well that his servants detested him, and that, even if he had visitors, they did not come for love of him, though some found a sort of amusement in his sharp, sarcastic talk, which spared no one. So long as he had been strong and well, he had gone from one place to another, pretending to amuse himself, though he had not really enjoyed it. And when his health began to fail, he felt tired of everything and shut himself up at Dorincourt, with his gout and his newspapers and his books. But he could not read all the time, and he became more and more bored, as he called it. He hated the long nights and days, and he grew more and more savage and irritable. And then Fauntleroy came, and when the Earl saw him, fortunately for the little fellow, the secret pride of the grandfather was gratified at the outset. If Cedric had been a less handsome little fellow, the old man might have taken so strong a dislike to him that he would not have given himself the chance to see his grandson's finer qualities. But he chose to think that Cedric's beauty and fearless spirit were the results of the Dorincourt blood and a credit to the Dorincourt rank. And then when he heard the lad talk and saw what a well-bred little fellow he was, notwithstanding his boyish ignorance of all that his new position meant, the old Earl liked his grandson more, and actually began to find himself rather entertained. It had amused him to give into those childish hands the power to bestow a benefit on poor Higgins. My lord cared nothing for poor Higgins, but it pleased him a little to think that his grandson would be talked about by the country people, and would begin to be popular with the tenantry, even in his childhood. Then it had gratified him to drive to church with Cedric, and to see the excitement and interest caused by the arrival. He knew how people would speak of the beauty of the little lad, of his fine, strong, straight body, of his erect bearing, his handsome face, and his bright hair, and how they would say, as the Earl had heard one woman exclaim to another, that the boy was every inch a lord. My Lord of Dorincourt was an arrogant old man, proud of his name, proud of his rank, and therefore proud to show the world that at last the House of Dorincourt had an heir who was worthy of the position he was to fill. The morning the new pony had been tried, the Earl had been so pleased that he had almost forgotten his gout. When the groom had brought out the pretty creature, which arched its brown glossy neck and tossed its fine head in the sun, the Earl had sat at the open window of the library and had looked on while Fauntleroy took his first riding lesson. He wondered if the boy would show signs of timidity. It was not a very small pony, and he had often seen children lose courage in making their first essay at riding. Fauntleroy mounted in great delight. He had never been on a pony before, and he was in the highest spirits. Wilkins, the groom, led the animal by the bridle up and down before the library window. "He's a well-plucked un, he is," Wilkins remarked in the stable afterward with many grins. "It weren't no trouble to put him up, and an old un wouldn't have sat any straighter when he were up. He says he to me, 'Wilkins,' he said, 'am I sitting up straight?' 'They sit up straight at the circus,' says he. And I says, 'As straight as a arrer, your lordship.' And he laughs as pleased as could be, and he says, 'That's right,' he says. 'You tell me if I don't sit up straight, Wilkins.' But sitting up straight and being led at a walk were not altogether and completely satisfactory. After a few minutes, Fauntleroy spoke to his grandfather, watching him from the window. 'Can't I go by myself?' he asked. 'And can't I go faster? The boy on Fifth Avenue used to trot and canter.'
'Do you think you could trot and canter?' said the Earl.
'I should like to try,' answered Fauntleroy.
His lordship made a sign to Wilkins, who at the signal brought up his own horse and mounted it, and took Fauntleroy's pony by the leading rein.
'Now,' said the Earl, 'let him trot.'
The next few minutes were rather exciting to the small equestrian. He found that trotting was not so easy as walking, and the faster the pony trotted, the less easy it was.
"It jolts a good deal, doesn't it?" he said to Wilkins. "Does it you?"
"No, my lord," answered Wilkins. "You'll get used to it in time. Rise in your stirrups."
"I'm rising all the time," said Fauntleroy.
He was both rising and falling rather uncomfortably, and with many shakes and bounces. He was out of breath and his face grew red, but he held on with all his might and sat as straight as he could. The Earl could see that from his window. When the riders came back within speaking distance, after they had been hidden by the trees a few minutes, Fauntleroy's hat was off, his cheeks were like poppies, and his lips were set, but he was still trotting manfully.
"Stop a minute," said his grandfather. "Where's your hat?"
Wilkins touched his.
"It fell off, your lordship," he said, with evident enjoyment. "Wouldn't let me stop to pick it up, my lord." "Not much afraid, is he?" asked the Earl dryly. "Him, your lordship!" exclaimed Wilkins. "I shouldn't say as he knowed what it meant. I've taught young gentlemen to ride afore, and I never see one stick on more determineder." "Tired?" said the Earl to Fauntleroy. "Want to get off?"
"It jolts you more than you think it will," admitted his young lordship frankly. "And it tires you a little, too. But I don't want to get off. I want to learn how. As soon as I've got my breath, I want to go back for the hat."
The cleverest person in the world, if he had undertaken to teach Fauntleroy how to please the old man who watched him, could not have taught him anything which would have succeeded better. As the pony trotted off again toward the avenue, a faint color crept up in the fierce old face, and the eyes, under the shaggy brows, gleamed with a pleasure such as his lordship had scarcely expected to know again. And he sat and watched quite eagerly until the sound of the horse's hoofs returned. When they did come, which was after some time, they came at a faster pace. Fauntleroy's hat was still off. Wilkins was carrying it for him. His cheeks were redder than before, and his hair was flying about his ears, but he came at quite a brisk canter.
"There!" he panted as they drew up. "I cantered. I didn't do it as well as the boy on Fifth Avenue, but I did it, and I stayed on."
He and Wilkins and the pony were close friends after that. Scarcely a day passed in which the country people did not see them out together, cantering gaily on the high road or through the green lanes. The children in the cottages would run to the door to look at the proud little brown pony with the gallant little figure sitting so straight in the saddle, and the young lord would snatch off his cap and swing it at them and shout, "Hello! Good morning!" in a very unlordly manner, though with great heartiness. Sometimes he would stop and talk with the children, and once Wilkins came back to the castle with a story of how Fauntleroy had insisted on dismounting near the village school so that a boy who was lame and tired might ride home on his pony. "And I'm blessed," said Wilkins in telling the story at the stables. "I'm blessed if he'd hear of anything else. He wouldn't let me get down because he said the boy mightn't feel comfortable on a big horse. And says he, 'Wilkins,' says he, 'that boy's lame, and I'm not, and I want to talk to him, too.' And up the lad has to get, and my lord trudges alongside of him with his hands in his pockets and his cap on the back of his head, a whistlin' and talkin' as easy as you please. And when we come to the cottage, and the boy's mother come out all in a takin' to see what's up, he whips off his cap and says he, 'I've brought your son home, ma'am,' says he, 'because his leg hurt him, and I don't think that stick is enough for him to lean on, and I'm going to ask my grandfather to have a pair of crutches made for him.' And I'm blessed if the woman wasn't struck all of a heap, as well she might be. I thought I should have exploded myself." When the Earl heard the story, he was not angry, as Wilkins had been half afraid that he would be. On the contrary, he laughed outright and called Fauntleroy up to him and made him tell all about the matter from beginning to end, and then he laughed again. And actually, a few days later, the Dorincourt carriage stopped in the green lane before the cottage where the lame boy lived, and Fauntleroy jumped out and walked up to the door, carrying a pair of strong, light, new crutches, shouldered like a gun, and presented them to Mrs. Hartle, the lame boy's name was Hartle, with these words, "My grandfather's compliments, and if you please, these are for your boy, and we hope he will get better." "I said your compliments," he explained to the Earl when he returned to the carriage. "You didn't tell me to, but I thought perhaps you forgot. That was right, wasn't it?" And the Earl laughed again and did not say it was not. In fact, the two were becoming more intimate every day, and every day Fauntleroy's faith in his lordship's benevolence and virtue increased. He had no doubt whatever that his grandfather was the most amiable and generous of elderly gentlemen. Certainly he himself found his wishes gratified almost before they were uttered, and such gifts and pleasures were lavished upon him that he was sometimes almost bewildered by his own possessions. Apparently, he was to have everything he wanted, and to do everything he wished to do. And though this certainly would not have been a very wise plan to pursue with all small boys, his young lordship bore it amazingly well. Perhaps notwithstanding his sweet nature, he might have been somewhat spoiled by it, if it had not been for the hours he spent with his mother at Court Lodge. That best friend of his watched over him ever closely and tenderly. The two had many long talks together, and he never went back to the castle with her kisses on his cheeks without carrying in his heart some simple, pure words worth remembering. There was one thing, it is true, which puzzled the little fellow very much. He thought over the mystery of it much oftener than anyone supposed. Even his mother did not know how often he pondered on it. The Earl, for a long time, never suspected that he did so at all. But being quick to observe, the little boy could not help wondering why it was that his mother and grandfather never seemed to meet. He had noticed that they never did meet. When the Dorincourt carriage stopped at Court Lodge, the Earl never alighted. And on the rare occasions of his lordship's going to church, Fauntleroy was always left to speak to his mother in the porch alone, or perhaps to go home with her. and yet every day fruit and flowers were sent to Court Lodge from the hothouses at the castle. But the one virtuous action of the Earl's which had set him upon the pinnacle of perfection in Cedric's eyes was what he had done soon after that first Sunday when Mrs. Errol had walked home from church unattended. About a week later, when Cedric was going one day to visit his mother, he found at the door, instead of the large carriage and prancing pair, a pretty little brougham and a handsome bay horse.
"This is a present from you to your mother," the Earl said abruptly. "She cannot go walking about the country. She needs a carriage. The man who drives will take charge of it. It is a present from you."
Fauntleroy's delight could but feebly express itself. He could scarcely contain himself until he reached the lodge. His mother was gathering roses in the garden. He flung himself out of the little brougham and flew to her.
"Dearest," he cried, "could you believe it? This is yours. He says it is a present from me. It is your own carriage to drive everywhere in."
He was so happy that she did not know what to say. She could not have borne to spoil his pleasure by refusing to accept the gift, even though it came from the man who chose to consider himself her enemy. She was obliged to step into the carriage, roses and all, and let herself be taken to drive, while Fauntleroy told her stories of his grandfather's goodness and amiability. They were such innocent stories that sometimes she could not help laughing a little, and then she would draw her little boy closer to her side and kiss him, feeling glad that he could see only good in the old man, who had so few friends. The very next day after that, Fauntleroy wrote to Mr. Hobbs. He wrote quite a long letter, and after the first copy was written, he brought it to his grandfather to be inspected.
"Because," he said, "it's so uncertain about the spelling, and if you tell me the mistakes, I'll write it out again."
This is what he had written.
"My dear Mr. Hobbs, I want to tell you about my grandfather. He is the best earl you ever knew. It is a mistake about earls being tyrants. He is not a tyrant at all. I wish you knew him. You would be good friends. I am sure you would. He has gout in his foot and is a great sufferer. But he is so patient. I love him more every day because no one could help loving an earl like that who is kind to everyone in this world. I wish you could talk to him. He knows everything in the world. You can ask him any question. But he has never played baseball. He has given me a pony and a cart, and my mamma has a beautiful carriage. And I have three rooms and toys of all kinds. It would surprise you. You would like the castle and the park. It is such a large castle. You could lose yourself, Wilkins tells me. Wilkins is my groom. He says there is a dungeon under the castle. It is so pretty, everything in the park would surprise you. There are such big trees, and there are deers and rabbits and games flying about in the cover. My grandfather is very rich, but he is not proud and ornery, as you thought earls always were. I like to be with him. The people are so polite and kind. They take off their hats to you, and the women make curtsies, and sometimes say, 'God bless you.' I can ride now, but at first it shook me when I trotted. My grandfather let a poor man stay on his farm when he could not pay his rent, and Mrs. Mellon went to take wine and things to his sick children. I should like to see you, and I wish Dearest could live at the castle, but I am very happy when I don't miss her too much. And I love my grandfather. Everyone does. Please write soon. Your affectionate old friend, Cedric Errol. P.S. No one is in the dungeon. My grandfather never had anyone languishing in there. P.S. He is such a good earl. He reminds me of you. He is a universal favorite."
"Do you miss your mother very much?" asked the earl when he had finished reading this.
"Yes," said Fauntleroy. "I miss her all the time."
He went and stood before the earl and put his hand on his knee, looking up at him.
"You don't miss her, do you?" he said.
"I don't know her," answered his lordship rather crustily.
"I know that," said Fauntleroy, "and that's what makes me wonder. She told me not to ask you any questions, and I won't. But sometimes I can't help thinking, you know, and it makes me all puzzled. But I'm not going to ask any questions. and when I miss her very much, I go and look out my window to where I see her light shine for me every night through an open place in the trees. It is a long way off, but she puts it in her window as soon as it is dark, and I can see it twinkle far away, and I know what it says."
"What does it say?" asked my lord.
"It says, 'Good night. God keep you all the night.' Just what she used to say when we were together. Every night she used to say that to me, and every morning she said, 'God bless you all the day.' So you see, I am quite safe all the time."
"Quite, I have no doubt," said his lordship dryly.
And he drew down his beetling brows and looked at the little boy so fixedly and so long that Fauntleroy wondered what he could be thinking of.
End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 9. The fact was, his lordship the Earl of Dorincourt thought in those days of many things of which he had never thought before, and all his thoughts were in one way or another connected with his grandson. His pride was the strongest part of his nature, and the boy gratified it at every point. Through this pride he began to find a new interest in life. He began to take pleasure in showing his heir to the world. The world had known of his disappointment in his sons, so there was an agreeable touch of triumph in exhibiting this new Lord Fauntleroy, who could disappoint no one. He wished the child to appreciate his own power and to understand the splendor of his position. He wished that others should realize it too. He made plans for his future. Sometimes in secret he actually found himself wishing that his own past life had been a better one, and that there had been less in it that this pure, childish heart would shrink from if it knew the truth. It was not agreeable to think how the beautiful, innocent face would look if its owner should be made by any chance to understand that his grandfather had been called for many a year the wicked Earl of Dorincourt. The thought even made him a trifle nervous. He did not wish the boy to find it out. Sometimes in this new interest he forgot his gout, and after a while his doctor was surprised to find his noble patient's health growing better than he had expected it ever would be again. Perhaps the Earl grew better because the time did not pass so slowly for him, and he had something to think of besides his pains and infirmities. One fine morning, people were amazed to see little Lord Fauntleroy riding his pony with another companion than Wilkins. This new companion rode a tall, powerful gray horse, and was no other than the Earl himself. It was, in fact, Fauntleroy who had suggested this plan. As he had been on the point of mounting his pony, he had said rather wistfully to his grandfather, "I wish you were going with me. When I go away, I feel lonely because you are left all by yourself in such a big castle. I wish you could ride, too." And the greatest excitement had been aroused in the stables a few minutes later by the arrival of an order that Selim was to be saddled for the Earl. After that, Selim was saddled almost every day, and the people became accustomed to the sight of the tall gray horse carrying the tall gray old man with his handsome, fierce eagle face, by the side of the brown pony which bore little Lord Fauntleroy. And in their rides together through the green lanes and pretty country roads, the two riders became more intimate than ever. And gradually the old man heard a great deal about Dearest and her life. As Fauntleroy trotted by the big horse, he chatted gaily. There could not well have been a brighter little comrade, his nature was so happy. It was he who talked the most. The Earl was often silent, listening and watching the joyous, glowing face. Sometimes he would tell his young companion to set the pony off at a gallop, and when the little fellow dashed off, sitting so straight and fearless, he would watch him with a gleam of pride and pleasure in his eyes. And when, after such a dash, Fauntleroy came back waving his cap with a laughing shout, he always felt that he and his grandfather were very good friends indeed. One thing that the Earl discovered was that his son's wife did not lead an idle life. It was not long before he learned that the poor people knew her very well indeed. When there was sickness or sorrow or poverty in any house, the little brougham often stood before the door. "Do you know," said Fauntleroy once, "they all say 'God bless you' when they see her, and the children are glad. There are some who go to her house to be taught to sew. She says she feels so rich now that she wants to help the poor ones." It had not displeased the Earl to find that the mother of his heir had a beautiful young face and looked as much like a lady as if she had been a duchess. And in one way it did not displease him to know that she was popular and beloved by the poor. And yet he was often conscious of a hard, jealous pang when he saw how she filled her child's heart and how the boy clung to her as his best beloved. The old man would have desired to stand first himself and have no rival. That same morning he drew up his horse on an elevated point of the moor over which they rode, and made a gesture with his whip over the broad, beautiful landscape spread before them. "Do you know that all that land belongs to me?" he said to Fauntleroy.
"Does it?" answered Fauntleroy. "How much it is to belong to one person, and how beautiful!"
"Do you know that some day it will all belong to you, that and a great deal more?"
"To me?" exclaimed Fauntleroy in rather an awe-stricken voice. "When?"
"When I am dead," his grandfather answered.
"Then I don't want it," said Fauntleroy. "I want you to live always."
"That's kind," answered the Earl in his dry way. "Nevertheless, some day it will all be yours. Some day you will be the Earl of Dorincourt."
Little Lord Fauntleroy sat very still in his saddle for a few moments. He looked over the broad moors, the green farms, the beautiful copses, the cottages in the lanes, the pretty village, and over the trees to where the turrets of the great castle rose, gray and stately. Then he gave a queer little sigh.
"What are you thinking of?" asked the Earl.
"I am thinking," replied Fauntleroy, "what a little boy I am, and of what Dearest said to me."
"What was it?" inquired the Earl.
"She said that perhaps it was not so easy to be very rich, that if anyone had so many things always, one might sometimes forget that everyone else was not so fortunate, and that one who is rich should always be careful and try to remember. I was talking to her about how good you were, and she said that was such a good thing, because an earl had so much power. And if he cared only about his own pleasure and never thought about the people who lived on his lands, they might have trouble that he could help. And there were so many people, and it would be such a hard thing. And I was just looking at all those houses and thinking how I should have to find out about the people when I was an earl. How did you find out about them?"
As his lordship's knowledge of his tenantry consisted in finding out which of them paid their rent promptly, and in turning out those who did not, this was rather a hard question.
"Newick finds out for me," he said, and he pulled his great gray mustache and looked at his small questioner rather uneasily. "We will go home now," he added, "and when you are an earl, see to it that you are a better earl than I have been."
He was very silent as they rode home. He felt it to be almost incredible that he, who had never really loved anyone in his life, should find himself growing so fond of this little fellow, as without doubt he was. At first he had only been pleased and proud of Cedric's beauty and bravery, but there was something more than pride in his feeling now. He laughed a grim, dry laugh all to himself sometimes when he thought how he liked to have the boy near him, how he liked to hear his voice, and how, in secret, he really wished to be liked and thought well of by his small grandson.
"I'm an old fellow in my dotage, and I have nothing else to think of," he would say to himself.
And yet he knew it was not that altogether. And if he had allowed himself to admit the truth, he would perhaps have found himself obliged to own that the very things which attracted him, in spite of himself,
were the qualities he had never possessed. The frank, true, kindly nature, the affectionate trustfulness which could never think evil. It was only about a week after that ride when, after a visit to his mother, Fauntleroy came into the library with a troubled, thoughtful face. He sat down in that high-backed chair in which he had sat on the evening of his arrival, and for a while he looked at the embers on the hearth. The Earl watched him in silence, wondering what was coming. It was evident that Cedric had something on his mind. At last he looked up.
"Does Newick know all about the people?" he asked.
"It is his business to know about them," said his lordship. "Been neglecting it, has he?"
Contradictory as it may seem, there was nothing which entertained and edified him more than the little fellow's interest in his tenantry. He had never taken any interest in them himself, but it pleased him well enough that, with all his childish habits of thought, and in the midst of all his childish amusements and high spirits, there should be such a quaint seriousness working in the curly head.
"There is a place," said Fauntleroy, looking up at him with wide-open, horror-stricken eyes. "Dearest has seen it. It is at the other end of the village. The houses are close together and almost falling down. You can scarcely breathe. And the people are so poor and everything is dreadful. Often they have fever and the children die. And it makes them wicked to live like that and be so poor and miserable. It is worse than Michael and Bridget. The rain comes in at the roof. Dearest went to see a poor woman who lived there. She would not let me come near her until she had changed all her things. The tears ran down her cheeks when she told me about it."
The tears had come into his own eyes, but he smiled through them.
"I told her you didn't know, and I would tell you," he said. He jumped down and came and leaned against the Earl's chair. "You can make it all right," he said, "just as you made it all right for Higgins. You always make it all right for everybody. I told her you would, and that Newick must have forgotten to tell you."
The Earl looked down at the hand on his knee. Newick had not forgotten to tell him. In fact, Newick had spoken to him more than once of the desperate condition of the end of the village known as Earl's Court. He knew all about the tumble-down, miserable cottages and the bad drainage, and the damp walls and broken windows and leaking roofs, and all about the poverty, the fever, and the misery. Mr. Mordaunt had painted it all to him in the strongest words he could use, and his lordship had used violent language in response. And when his gout had been at the worst, he had said that the sooner the people of Earl's Court died and were buried by the parish, the better it would be. And there was an end of the matter. And yet, as he looked at the small hand on his knee, and from the small hand to the honest, earnest, frank-eyed face, he was actually a little ashamed, both of Earl's Court and himself.
"What?" he said. "You want to make a builder of model cottages of me, do you?"
And he positively put his own hand upon the childish one and stroked it.
"Those must be pulled down," said Fauntleroy with great eagerness. "Dearest says so. Let us go and have them pulled down tomorrow. The people will be so glad when they see you. They'll know you have come to help them."
And his eyes shone like stars in his glowing face. The Earl rose from his chair and put his hand on the child's shoulder.
"Let us go out and take our walk on the terrace," he said with a short laugh, "and we can talk it over."
And though he laughed two or three times again as they walked to and fro on the broad stone terrace, where they walked together almost every fine evening, he seemed to be thinking of something which did not displease him, and still he kept his hand on his small companion's shoulder. End of chapter 9. Chapter 10 of Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Susan Umpleby. Little Lord Fauntleroy by Francis Hodgson Burnett. Chapter 10.
The truth was that Mrs. Errol had found a great many sad things in the course of her work among the poor of the little village that appeared so picturesque when it was seen from the moorsides. Everything was not as picturesque when seen nearby as it looked from a distance. She had found idleness and poverty and ignorance where there should have been comfort and industry. And she had discovered, after a while, that Erleboro was considered to be the worst village in that part of the country. Mr. Mordaunt had told her a great many of his difficulties and discouragements, and she had found out a great deal by herself. The agents who had managed the property had always been chosen to please the Earl, and had cared nothing for the degradation and wretchedness of the poor tenants. Many things, therefore, had been neglected, which should have been attended to, and matters had gone from bad to worse. As to Earl's Court, it was a disgrace, with its dilapidated houses and miserable, careless, sickly people. When first Mrs. Errol went to the place, it made her shudder. Such ugliness and slovenliness and want seemed worse in a country place than in a city. It seemed as if there it might be helped. And as she looked at the squalid, uncared-for children growing up in the midst of vice and brutal indifference, she thought of her own little boy, spending his days in the great, splendid castle, guarded and served like a young prince, having no wish ungratified, and knowing nothing but luxury and ease and beauty. And a bold thought came in her wise little mother heart. Gradually she had begun to see, as had others, that it had been her boy's good fortune to please the Earl very much, and that he would scarcely be likely to be denied anything for which he expressed a desire. "The Earl would give him anything," she said to Mr. Mordaunt. "He would indulge his every whim. Why should not that indulgence be used for the good of others? It is for me to see that this shall come to pass." She knew she could trust the kind, childish heart, so she told the little fellow the story of Earl's Court, feeling sure that he would speak of it to his grandfather, and hoping that some good results would follow. And strange as it appeared to everyone, good results did follow. The fact was that the strongest power to influence the Earl was his grandson's perfect confidence in him, the fact that Cedric always believed that his grandfather was going to do what was right and generous. He could not quite make up his mind to let him discover that he had no inclination to be generous at all, and that he wanted his own way on all occasions, whether it was right or wrong. It was such a novelty to be regarded with admiration as a benefactor of the entire human race and the soul of nobility that he did not enjoy the idea of looking into the affectionate brown eyes and saying, "I am a violent, selfish old rascal. I never did a generous thing in my life, and I don't care about Earl's Court or the poor people," or something which would amount to the same thing. He actually had learned to be fond enough of that small boy with the mop of yellow lovelocks to feel that he himself would prefer to be guilty of an amiable action now and then. And so, though he laughed at himself, after some reflection he sent for Newick and had quite a long interview with him on the subject of the court. And it was decided that the wretched hovels should be pulled down and new houses should be built.
"It is Lord Fauntleroy who insists on it," he said dryly. "He thinks it will improve the property. You can tell the tenants that it's his idea." And he looked down at his small lordship, who was lying on the hearthrug playing with Dougal. The great dog was the lad's constant companion, and followed him about everywhere, stalking solemnly after him when he walked, and trotting majestically behind when he rode or drove. Of course, both the country people and the town people heard of the proposed improvement. At first, many of them would not believe it. But when a small army of workmen arrived and commenced pulling down the crazy, squalid cottages, people began to understand that little Lord Fauntleroy had done them a good turn again, and that through his innocent interference, the scandal of Earl's Court had at last been removed. If he had only known how they talked about him and praised him everywhere and prophesied great things for him when he grew up, how astonished he would have been! But he never suspected it. He lived his simple, happy child life, frolicking about in the park, chasing the rabbits to their burrows,
lying under the trees on the grass or on the rug in the library, reading wonderful books and talking to the Earl about them, and telling the stories again to his mother, writing long letters to Dick and Mr. Hobbs, who responded in characteristic fashion, riding out at his grandfather's side or with Wilkins as escort. As they rode through the market town, he used to see the people turn and look, and he noticed that, as they lifted their hats, their faces often brightened very much. But he thought it was all because his grandfather was with him. "They are so fond of you," he once said, looking up at his lordship with a bright smile. "Do you see how glad they are when they see you? I hope they will someday be as fond of me. It must be nice to have everybody like you." And he felt quite proud to be the grandson of so greatly admired and beloved an individual. When the cottages were being built, the lad and his grandfather used to ride over to Earl's Court together to look at them, and Fauntleroy was full of interest. He would dismount from his pony and go and make acquaintance with the workmen, asking them questions about building and bricklaying and telling them things about America. After two or three such conversations, he was able to enlighten the Earl on the subject of brickmaking as they rode home. "I always like to know about things like those," he said, "because you never know what you are coming to." When he left them, the workmen used to talk him over among themselves and laugh at his odd, innocent speeches, but they liked him and liked to see him stand among them, talking away with his hands in his pockets, his hat pushed back on his curls, and his small face full of eagerness. "He's a rare un," they used to say. "And a nice little outspoken chap, too. Not much of the bad stock in him." And they would go home and tell their wives about him, and the women would tell each other. And so it came about that almost everyone talked of, or knew some story of, little Lord Fauntleroy. And gradually, almost everyone knew that the wicked Earl had found something he cared for at last, something which had touched and even warmed his hard, bitter old heart. But no one knew quite how much it had been warmed, and how day by day the old man found himself caring more and more for the child, who was the only creature that had ever trusted him. He found himself looking forward to the time when Cedric would be a young man, strong and beautiful, with life all before him, but having still that kind heart and the power to make friends everywhere. And the Earl wondered what the lad would do and how he would use his gifts. Often, as he watched the little fellow lying upon the hearth, conning some big book, the light shining on the bright young head, his old eyes would gleam and his cheek would flush. "The boy can do anything," he would say to himself. "Anything!" He never spoke to anyone else of his feeling for Cedric. When he spoke of him to others, it was always with the same grim smile. But Fauntleroy soon knew that his grandfather loved him and always liked him to be near to his chair if they were in the library, opposite to him at table, or by his side when he rode or drove or took his evening walk on the broad terrace. "Do you remember," Cedric said once, looking up from his book as he lay on the rug, "do you remember what I said to you that first night about our being good companions? I don't think any people could be better companions than we are, do you?"
"We are pretty good companions, I should say," replied his lordship. "Come here."
Fauntleroy scrambled up and went to him.
"Is there anything you want?" the Earl asked. "Anything you have not?"
The little fellow's brown eyes fixed themselves on his grandfather with a rather wistful look.
"Only one thing," he answered.
"What is that?" inquired the Earl.
Fauntleroy was silent a second. He had not thought matters over to himself so long for nothing.
"What is it?" my lord repeated.
Fauntleroy answered.
"It is Dearest," he said.
The old Earl winced a little.
"But you see her almost every day," he said. "Is not that enough?"
"I used to see her all the time," said Fauntleroy. "She used to kiss me when I went to sleep at night, and in the morning she was always there, and we could tell each other things without waiting."
The old eyes and the young ones looked into each other through a moment of silence. Then the Earl knitted his brows. "Do you never forget about your mother?" he said.
"No," answered Fauntleroy, "never. And she never forgets about me. I shouldn't forget about you, you know, if I didn't live with you. I should think about you all the more."
"Upon my word," said the Earl, after looking at him a moment longer, "I believe you would."
The jealous pang that came when the boy spoke so of his mother seemed even stronger than it had been before. It was stronger because of this old man's increasing affection for the boy. But it was not long before he had other pangs, so much harder to face that he almost forgot, for the time, he had ever hated his son's wife at all. And in a strange and startling way it happened. One evening, just before the Earl's Court cottages were completed, there was a grand dinner party at Dorincourt. There had not been such a party at the castle for a long time. A few days before it took place, Sir Harry Lorridaile and Lady Lorridaile, who was the Earl's only sister, actually came for a visit, a thing which caused the greatest excitement in the village and set Mrs. Dibble's shop bell tinkling madly again, because it was well known that Lady Lorridaile had only been to Dorincourt once since her marriage, 35 years before. She was a handsome old lady with white curls and dimpled peachy cheeks, and she was as good as gold. But she had never approved of her brother any more than did the rest of the world, and, having a strong will of her own, and not being at all afraid to speak her mind frankly, she had, after several lively quarrels with his lordship, seen very little of him since her young days. She had heard a great deal of him that was not pleasant through the years in which they had been separated. She had heard about his neglect of his wife, and of the poor lady's death, and of his indifference to his children, and of the two weak, vicious, unprepossessing elder boys who had been no credit to him or to anyone else. Those two elder sons, Bevis and Morris, she had never seen. But once there had come to Lorridaile Park a tall, stalwart, beautiful young fellow about 18 years old, who had told her that he was her nephew, Cedric Errol, and that he had come to see her because he was passing near the place and wished to look at his Aunt Constantia, of whom he had heard his mother speak. Lady Lorridaile's kind heart had warmed through and through at the sight of the young man, and she had made him stay with her a week, and petted him, and made much of him, and admired him immensely. He was so sweet-tempered, light-hearted, and spirited a lad that when he went away, she had hoped to see him often again. But she never did, because the Earl had been in a bad humor when he went back to Dorincourt, and had forbidden him ever to go to Lorridaile Park again. But Lady Lorridaile had always remembered him tenderly, and though she feared he had made a rash marriage in America, she had been very angry when she heard how he had been cast off by his father, and that no one really knew where or how he lived. At last there came a rumor of his death, and then Bevis had been thrown from his horse and killed, and Morris had died in Rome of the fever. And soon after came the story of the American child who was to be found and brought home as Lord Fauntleroy. "Probably to be ruined as the others were," she said to her husband, "unless his mother is good enough and has a will of her own to help her take care of him." But when she heard that Cedric's mother had been parted from him, she was almost too indignant for words. "It is disgraceful, Harry," she said. "Fancy a child of that age being taken from his mother and made the companion of a man like my brother. He will either be brutal to the boy or indulge him until he is a little monster. If I thought it would do any good to write..."
"It wouldn't, Constantia," said Sir Harry.
"I know it wouldn't," she answered. "I know his lordship, the Earl of Dorincourt, too well. But it is outrageous."
Not only the poor people and farmers heard about little Lord Fauntleroy. Others knew him. He was talked about so much, and there were so many stories of him, of his beauty, his sweet temper, his popularity, and his growing influence over the Earl, his grandfather, that rumors of him reached the gentry at their country places, and he was heard of in more than one county in England. People talked about him at the dinner tables. Ladies pitied his young mother, and wondered if the boy were as handsome as he was said to be. And men, who knew the Earl and his habits, laughed heartily at the stories of the little fellow's belief in his lordship's amiability. Sir Thomas Ashe of Ashshaw Hall, being in Erleboro one day, met the Earl and his grandson riding together, and stopped to shake hands with my lord and congratulate him on his change of looks and on his recovery from the gout. "And do you know," he said, when he spoke of the incident afterward, "the old man looked as proud as a turkey-cock, and upon my word, I don't wonder, for a handsomer, finer lad than his grandson I never saw. As straight as a dart, and sat his pony like a young trooper." And so, by degrees, Lady Lorridaile, too, heard of the child. She heard about Higgins and the lame boy, and the cottages at Earl's Court, and a score of other things. And she began to wish to see the little fellow. And just as she was wondering how it might be brought about, to her utter astonishment, she received a letter from her brother, inviting her to come with her husband to Dorincourt. "It seems incredible," she exclaimed. "I have heard it said that the child has worked miracles, and I begin to believe it. They say my brother adores the boy and can scarcely endure to have him out of sight. And he is so proud of him. Actually, I believe he wants to show him to us." And she accepted the invitation at once. When she reached Dorincourt Castle with Sir Harry, it was late in the afternoon, and she went to her room at once before seeing her brother. Having dressed for dinner, she entered the drawing-room. The Earl was there, standing near the fire and looking very tall and imposing. And at his side stood a little boy in black velvet and a large Van Dyck collar of rich lace. A little fellow whose round, bright face was so handsome and who turned upon her such beautiful, candid brown eyes that she almost uttered an exclamation of pleasure and surprise at the sight. As she shook hands with the Earl, she called him by the name she had not used since her girlhood. "What, Molyneux," she said, "is this the child?" "Yes, Constantia," answered the Earl. "This is the boy. Fauntleroy, this is your grand-aunt, Lady Lorridaile."
"How do you do, grand-aunt?" said Fauntleroy.
Lady Lorridaile put her hand on his shoulders and, after looking down into his upraised face a few seconds, kissed him warmly. "I am your Aunt Constantia," she said, "and I loved your poor papa, and you are very like him."
"It makes me glad when I am told I am like him," answered Fauntleroy, "because it seems as if everyone liked him. Just like dearest, exactly, Aunt Constantia," adding the two words after a second's pause.
Lady Lorridaile was delighted. She bent and kissed him again, and from that moment they were warm friends.
"Well, Molyneux," she said aside to the Earl afterward, "it could not possibly be better than this."
"I think not," answered his lordship dryly. "He is a fine little fellow. We are great friends. He believes me to be the most charming and sweet-tempered of philanthropists. I will confess to you, Constantia, as you would find it out if I did not, that I am in some slight danger of becoming rather an old fool about him."
"What does his mother think of you?" asked Lady Lorridaile, with her usual straightforwardness.
"I have not asked her," answered the Earl, slightly scowling.
"Well," said Lady Lorridaile, "I will be frank with you at the outset, Molyneux, and tell you I don't approve of your course, and that it is my intention to call on Mrs. Errol as soon as possible. So if you wish to quarrel with me, you had better mention it at once. What I hear of the young creature makes me quite sure that her child owes her everything. We were told, even at Lorridaile Park, that your poorer tenants adore her already."
"They adore him," said the Earl, nodding toward Fauntleroy. "As to Mrs. Errol, you'll find her a pretty little woman. I'm rather in debt to her for giving some of her beauty to the boy, and you can go see her if you like. All I ask is that she will remain at Court Lodge, and that you will not ask me to go and see her."
And he scowled a little again. "But he doesn't hate her as much as he used to. That is plain enough to me," her ladyship said to Sir Harry afterward. "And he is a changed man in a measure, and incredible as it may seem, Harry, it is my opinion that he is being made into a human being through nothing more nor less than his affection for that innocent, affectionate little fellow. Why, the child actually loves him, leans on his chair and against his knee. His own children would as soon have thought of nestling up to a tiger." The very next day she went to call upon Mrs. Errol. When she returned, she said to her brother, "Molyneux, she is the loveliest little woman I ever saw. She has a voice like a silver bell, and you may thank her for making the boy what he is. She has given him more than her beauty, and you make a great mistake in not persuading her to come and take charge of you. I shall invite her to Lorridaile."
"She'll not leave the boy," replied the Earl.
"I must have the boy, too," said Lady Lorridaile, laughing. But she knew Fauntleroy would not be given up to her, and each day she saw more clearly how closely those two had grown to each other, and how all the proud, grim old man's ambition and love and hope centered themselves in the child, and how the warm, innocent nature returned his affection with most perfect trust and good faith. She knew, too, that the prime reason for the great dinner party was the Earl's secret desire to show the world his grandson and heir, and to let people see that the boy who had been so much spoken of and described was even a finer little specimen of boyhood than rumor had made him. "Bevis and Morris were such a bitter humiliation to him," she said to her husband. "Everyone knew it. He actually hated them. His pride has full sway here." Perhaps there was not one person who accepted the invitation without feeling some curiosity about little Lord Fauntleroy and wondering if he would be on view. And when the time came, he was on view.
"The lad has good manners," said the Earl. "He will be in no one's way. Children are usually idiots or bores. Mine were both. But he can actually answer when he's spoken to and be silent when he is not. He is never offensive."
But he was not allowed to be silent very long. Everyone had something to say to him. The fact was, they wished to make him talk. The ladies petted him and asked him questions, and the men asked him questions too, and joked with him, as the men on the steamer had done when he crossed the Atlantic. Fauntleroy did not quite understand why they laughed so sometimes when he answered them, but he was so used to seeing people amused when he was quite serious that he did not mind. He thought the whole evening delightful. The magnificent rooms were so brilliant with lights, there were so many flowers, the gentlemen seemed so gay, and the ladies wore such beautiful, wonderful dresses and such sparkling ornaments in their hair and on their necks. There was one young lady who, he heard them say, had just come down from London, where she had spent the season, and she was so charming that he could not keep his eyes from her. She was a rather tall young lady with a proud little head and very soft dark hair and large eyes the color of purple pansies, and the color on her cheeks and lips was like that of a rose. She was dressed in a beautiful white dress and had pearls around her throat. There was one strange thing about this young lady. So many gentlemen stood near her and seemed so anxious to please her that Fauntleroy thought she must be something like a princess. He was so much interested in her that, without knowing it, he drew nearer and nearer to her, and at last she turned and spoke to him. "Come here, Lord Fauntleroy," she said, smiling, "and tell me why you look at me so." "I was thinking how beautiful you are," his young lordship replied. Then all the gentlemen laughed outright, and the young lady laughed a little too, and the rose color in her cheeks brightened.
"Ah, Fauntleroy," said one of the gentlemen who had laughed most heartily, "make the most of your time. When you are older, you will not have the courage to say that."
"But nobody could help saying it," said Fauntleroy sweetly. "Could you help it? Don't you think she is pretty too?"
"We are not allowed to say what we think," said the gentleman, while the rest laughed more than ever.
But the beautiful young lady, her name was Miss Vivian Herbert, put out her hand and drew Cedric to her side, looking prettier than before, if possible. "Lord Fauntleroy shall say what he thinks," she said, "and I am much obliged to him. I am sure he thinks what he says," and she kissed him on his cheek. "I think you are prettier than anyone I ever saw," said Fauntleroy, looking at her with innocent, admiring eyes, "except Dearest. Of course, I couldn't think anyone quite as pretty as Dearest.
I think she is the prettiest person in the world."
"I am sure she is," said Miss Vivian Herbert, and she laughed and kissed his cheek again. She kept him by her side a great part of the evening, and the group of which they were the center was very gay. He did not know how it happened, but before long he was telling them all about America and the Republican rally and Mr. Hobbs and Dick, and in the end he proudly produced from his pocket Dick's parting gift, the red silk handkerchief. "I put it in my pocket tonight because it was a party," he said. "I thought Dick would like me to wear it at a party." And queer as the big flaming spotted thing was, there was a serious, affectionate look in his eyes which prevented his audience from laughing very much. "You see, I like it," he said, "because Dick is my friend." But though he was talked to so much, as the Earl had said, he was in no one's way. He could be quiet and listen when others talked, and so no one found him tiresome. A slight smile crossed more than one face when several times he went and stood near his grandfather's chair, or sat on a stool close to him, watching him and absorbing every word he uttered with the most charmed interest. Once he stood so near the chair's arm that his cheek touched the Earl's shoulder, and his lordship, detecting the general's smile, smiled a little himself. He knew what the lookers-on were thinking, and he felt some secret amusement in their seeing what good friends he was with this youngster, who might have been expected to share the popular opinion of him. Mr. Havisham had been expected to arrive in the afternoon, but, strange to say, he was late. Such a thing had really never been known to happen before during all the years in which he had been a visitor at Dorincourt Castle. He was so late that the guests were on the point of rising to go into dinner when he arrived. When he approached his host, the Earl regarded him with amazement. He looked as if he had been hurried or agitated. His dry, keen old face was actually pale. "I was detained," he said in a low voice to the Earl, "by an extraordinary event." It was as unlike the methodic old lawyer to be agitated by anything as it was to be late, but it was evident that he had been disturbed. At dinner he ate scarcely anything, and two or three times, when he was spoken to, he started as if his thoughts were far away. At dessert, when Fauntleroy came in, he looked at him more than once, nervously and uneasily. Fauntleroy noted the look and wondered at it. He and Mr. Havisham were on friendly terms, and they usually exchanged smiles. The lawyer seemed to have forgotten to smile that evening. The fact was, he forgot everything but the strange and painful news he knew he must tell the Earl before the night was over, the strange news which he knew would be so terrible a shock, and which would change the face of everything. As he looked about at the splendid rooms and the brilliant company, at the people gathered together, he knew, more that they might see the bright-haired little fellow near the Earl's chair than for any other reason, as he looked at the proud old man and at little Lord Fauntleroy smiling at his side, he really felt quite shaken, notwithstanding that he was a hardened old lawyer. What a blow it was that he must deal them! He did not exactly know how the long, superb dinner ended. He sat through it as if he were in a dream, and several times he saw the Earl glance at him in surprise. But it was over at last, and the gentlemen joined the ladies in the drawing-room. They found Fauntleroy sitting on the sofa with Miss Vivian Herbert, the great beauty of the last London season. They had been looking at some pictures, and he was thanking his companion as the door opened. "I am ever so much obliged to you for being so kind to me," he was saying. "I never was at a party before, and I've enjoyed myself so much." He had enjoyed himself so much that when the gentlemen gathered about Miss Herbert again and began to talk to her, as he listened and tried to understand their laughing speeches, his eyelids began to droop. They drooped until they covered his eyes two or three times. And then the sound of Miss Herbert's low, pretty laugh would bring him back, and he would open them again for about 2 seconds. He was quite sure he was not going to sleep, but there was a large yellow satin cushion behind him, and his head sank against it, and after a while his eyelids drooped for the last time. They did not even quite open when, as it seemed a long time after, someone kissed him lightly on the cheek. It was Miss Vivian Herbert, who was going away, and she spoke to him softly. "Good night, little Lord Fauntleroy," she said. "Sleep well." And in the morning he did not know that he had tried to open his eyes and had murmured sleepily, "Good night. I'm so glad I saw you. You are so pretty." He only had a very faint recollection of hearing the gentleman laugh again and of wondering why they did it. No sooner had the last guest left the room than Mr. Havisham turned from his place by the fire and stepped nearer the sofa, where he stood looking down at the sleeping occupant. Little Lord Fauntleroy was taking his ease luxuriously. One leg crossed the other and swung over the edge of the sofa. One arm was flung easily above his head. The warm flush of healthful, happy, childish sleep was on his quiet face. His waving tangle of bright hair strayed over the yellow satin cushion. He made a picture well worth looking at. As Mr. Havisham looked at it, he put his hand up and rubbed his shaven chin with a harassed countenance.
"Well, Havisham," said the Earl's harsh voice behind him, "what is it? It is evident something has happened. What was the extraordinary event, if I may ask?"
Mr. Havisham turned from the sofa, still rubbing his chin. "It was bad news," he answered. "Distressing news, my lord. The worst of news. I am sorry to be the bearer of it." The Earl had been uneasy for some time during the evening, as he glanced at Mr. Havisham, and when he was uneasy, he was always ill-tempered.
"Why do you look so at the boy?" he exclaimed irritably. "You have been looking at him all the evening as if... See here now. Why should you look at the boy, Havisham, and hang over him like some bird of ill omen? What has your news to do with Lord Fauntleroy?"
"My lord," said Mr. Havisham, "I will waste no words. My news has everything to do with Lord Fauntleroy. And if we are to believe it, it is not Lord Fauntleroy who lies sleeping before us, but only the son of Captain Errol. And the present Lord Fauntleroy is the son of your son Bevis, and is at this moment in a lodging-house in London." The Earl clutched the arms of his chair with both his hands until the veins stood out upon them. The veins stood out upon his forehead, too. His fierce old face was almost livid.
"What do you mean?" he cried out. "You are mad. Whose lie is this?"
"If it is a lie," answered Mr. Havisham, "it is painfully like the truth. A woman came to my chambers this morning. She said your son Bevis married her 6 years ago in London. She showed me her marriage certificate. They quarreled a year after the marriage, and he paid her to keep away from him. She has a son 5 years old. She is an American of the lower classes, an ignorant person. And until lately, she did not fully understand what her son could claim. She consulted a lawyer and found out that the boy was really Lord Fauntleroy, and the heir to the earldom of Dorincourt, and she, of course, insists on his claims being acknowledged." There was a movement of the curly head on the yellow satin cushion. A soft, long, sleepy sigh came from the parted lips, and the little boy stirred in his sleep, but not at all restlessly or uneasily. Not at all as if his slumber were disturbed by the fact that he was being proved a small impostor, and that he was not Lord Fauntleroy at all, and never would be the Earl of Dorincourt. He only turned his rosy face more on its side, as if to enable the old man who stared at it so solemnly to see it better. The handsome, grim old face was ghastly. A bitter smile fixed itself upon it.
"I should refuse to believe a word of it," he said, "if it were not such a low, scoundrelly piece of business that it becomes quite possible in connection with the name of my son Bevis. It is quite like Bevis. He was always a disgrace to us, always a weak, untruthful, vicious young brute with low tastes. My son and heir, Bevis, Lord Fauntleroy."
"The woman is an ignorant, vulgar person, you say?" "I am obliged to admit that she can scarcely spell her own name," answered the lawyer. "She is absolutely uneducated and openly mercenary. She cares for nothing but the money. She is very handsome in a coarse way, but..." The fastidious old lawyer ceased speaking and gave a sort of shudder.
The veins on the old Earl's forehead stood out like purple cords. Something else stood out upon it, too. Cold drops of moisture. He took out his handkerchief and swept them away. His smile grew even more bitter.
"And I," he said, "I objected to the other woman, the mother of this child," pointing to the sleeping form on the sofa. "I refused to recognize her, and yet she could spell her own name. I suppose this is retribution."
Suddenly he sprang up from his chair and began to walk up and down the room. Fierce and terrible words poured forth from his lips. His rage and hatred and cruel disappointment shook him as a storm shakes a tree. His violence was something dreadful to see, and yet Mr. Havisham noticed that at the very worst of his wrath, he never seemed to forget the little sleeping figure on the yellow satin cushion, and that he never once spoke loud enough to awaken it.
"I might have known it," he said. "They were a disgrace to me from their first hour. I hated them both, and they hated me. Bevis was the worst of the two. I will not believe this yet, though. I will contend against it to the last. But it is like Bevis. It is like him."
And then he raged again and asked questions about the woman, about her proofs, and pacing the room, turned first white and then purple in his repressed fury. When at last he had learned all there was to be told and knew the worst, Mr. Havisham looked at him with a feeling of anxiety. He looked broken and haggard and changed. His rages had always been bad for him, but this one had been worse than the rest because there had been something more than rage in it. He came slowly back to the sofa at last and stood near it.
"If anyone had told me I could be fond of a child," he said, his harsh voice low and unsteady, "I should not have believed them. I always detested children, my own more than the rest. I am fond of this one. He is fond of me," with a bitter smile. "I am not popular. I never was, but he is fond of me. He never was afraid of me. He always trusted me. He would have filled my place better than I have filled it. I know that. He would have been an honor to the name."
He bent down and stood a minute or so looking at the happy, sleeping face. His shaggy eyebrows were knitted fiercely, and yet somehow he did not seem fierce at all. He put up his hand, pushing the bright hair back from the forehead, and then turned away and rang the bell. When the largest footman appeared, he pointed to the sofa.
"Take," he said, and then his voice changed a little. "Take Lord Fauntleroy to his room."
End of chapter 10.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.